Voice of Vashon, 101.9 here on lovely Vashon Island, Washington. I'm your host, Linda Nygaard, and I'm sitting here in the studio with some wonderful people. One's name is Tom Conway.
Woo-woo!
Hi, Tom.
Woo-hoo!
And the other one's name is Susan Help. I was going to say
Powell.
McCabe, but you're not Susan McCabe. You're Susan Powell.
So many Susans. All my life,
well,
so
you
many
know,
Susans.
I have to explain this because I have so many Susan friends that I have to say Chef Susan, Radio Susan, Tucson Susan, if ever I'm talking to people about my friend Susan, because I have five.
It's good to have qualifiers.
Well, and my kids one time said, I said, oh, I met a new friend, and I'm just so excited. And my daughter-in-law said, oh, is her name Susan? So anyway, that's a little off track. But
so I was listening to KUOW the other day, mm-hmm. and there's a call-in program. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it's national.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking for opinions, and they gave this very wise statement, short, brief, to the point, Susan from Vashon. And I'm sure it was Susan McCabe.
It probably was. Yeah. So anyway, gosh, it's nice to be back in the studio. We're going to be here for the next hour talking about all kinds of things, gabbing, interrupting each other probably. And
way of our people.
Well, it's kind of how we are.
It's how we roll. It's our jam.
Busy mouths. So we're trying out a new sort of schedule today, and we're going to run it by y'all and see how you feel about it. But we're going to name some of the sections, some of the segments, which we've never done before. But we'll do that as we go. So hello, you two. How have you been? What's been going on? Oh. What's your jam, Tom?
What's my jam? You know, there's so much going on. And then when you ask me, I have this like a sort of a, you know, if I was a cartoon, I would have a sort of a blank bubble above my head, but then perhaps that's my reality most of the time. you know, what's been going on is, I'm swimming in fruit. I got a lot of fruit and my refrigerator is chock-a-block with things that I want to make jams and jellies out of, and then pumpkins. This is a time of year where I like to process a pumpkin, so I've been totally into my. I love pumpkins for who and what they are, and what they do, and how they look, and if you are out there and you've never grown a pumpkin, especially if you have kids, because kids really love to watch a pumpkin grow because mm-hmm. it's such a dramatic. It's a dramatic growth rate. Once you plant like five of them and hope that two will maintain life mm-hmm. without the slugs or something else eating them, they just take off, and then you can water them and just watch the fruit grow over the summer.
And do you let them go, all of them on the vine, or do you sometimes selectively maybe pick one early so that
if you were
stay big?
If you were trying to grow one, like a couple giant ones, then mm-hmm. then I would pick the biggest and the healthiest and the sort of the earliest mm-hmm. Producers, and then at the other ones I'd nip off the vine, all the energy would go to those. For me, what I do is I tend to like them small because when you have a big pumpkin, you got to do something with it, and when you have a smaller pumpkin, you can sort of work through them at a more reasonable rate.
Yeah,
because I just usually roast them, and then
well, can you talk about pumpkin and squash, and is pumpkin a squash?
Yeah, they're all in the same family. Like a pumpkin is a squash. They're all in the same family. And so if you were making a pumpkin pie, you could easily make a pumpkin pie out of a butternut squash mm-hmm. or there's one called a sweet meat squash, which is a heirloom variety that was discovered in our pioneers brought it over from Oregon.
Mm.
And it's a really good one for pies. Another French one called Galou Dessin. And my favorite one to cook with, I think, is Winter Luxury. It's a small pumpkin, and it's easy to grow, and it's got a relatively dry meat to it, so you don't have to drain it. Like if you're making a pie, you don't want a soggy.
Right.
You don't want a lot of heavy liquid within it. It's very pasty in mm-hmm. a good way, in a very good way.
I love squash. I love pumpkin.
Yeah, and soup. You can make soups. I think mm-hmm. soups, pies. You know how we can't have a show without mentioning Jacques Pepin, our god, our food god, our chef god. But I watched his show, and he said that in France they don't use squash for sweet things like we do here, and he was showing how he would make gratins with squash.
I made a savory squash pie with puff pastry, and it has mushrooms and sage in it, and it's really
good.
Did you
bring some?
It's all gone.
Of course it is.
It's all gone. Susan, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, I was going to say I always roast my pumpkins.
Yeah.
And then you lose a lot of the moisture. Mm-hmm. And this week, swimming in fruit, I had, this little bit of pears left, not enough, and these apples that were going to go and whatever, you know. And I just tossed them with sugar, tossed them in the oven. And then I didn't know what I was going to do with them. And I went, I will make a pie out of them or a galette and no soggy bottom.
Nice.
Because, you know, usually when I make an apple pie, I mean, talking apple pie to Tom Conway is rather a little, not the best idea probably.
I love that I'm so... that
you're the pie god. You're the pie man.
If only you knew.
Yeah. you have to... I dust it with flour, so I don't get the soggy bottom.
Yeah.
And I looked at those and I went like, the easiest thing I could do would be to make... I made crummy pastry. I have to admit it was a crummy pastry, but the filling worked really well because... Then I drizzled a little cream on it with vanilla.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well.
That sounds really good. How do you roast your pumpkin usually?
Well, I never use a pumpkin. I always use butternut squash.
Oh, see, perfect. How do you do it for the same.
Yeah, I cut it in half and I take the seeds out and I put it upside down on a little sheet pan and I put about 1/4 inch of water around the whole pan and then I just let it go.
What do you bake it? What temperature do you usually bake it at?
350, 375, depends if I'm in a hurry.
But. Until it's soft, a knife can go through.
Yeah, if I poke it with a knife.
Okay.
And it's,
Yeah, that's what I do too.
Yeah.
Well, so then, there's the derivation of jack-o'-lanterns.
Yeah.
And I don't, do you do jack-o'-lanterns at this time of year?
You know, because there's the roastery, which lets us do it for them.
Yeah.
I'll go carve up there. But I don't do one at my house just because, I live
Buddy
up a lane.
And,
yeah.
Buddy will eat it.
Exactly. A big, long, spooky driveway to go up. Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much, I'm a traditionalist with the carving.
I know you are. I know you are. For our listening audience out there, that is one of our new segments. What's your jam? Uh-huh. And that's, Tom's jam this week is pumpkins. Susan, you have a jam this week, too.
Well, I just wanted to say about carving pumpkins.
Yeah.
Your power drill.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true.
There's lots of things you can do with your power drill.
Yeah, there is.
Anyway, thinking of things that are all over the island at this year, and it's this time of the year, and we mentioned it a little bit the last time we talked a little bit about quince. And with a friend in town, we had been driving all different places, showing her the lighthouse and whatnot, and I was really struck by how many of the older farmhouse yards I saw with quince trees in them. And I think that we don't plant them.
Yeah.
We have planted at our house, we've planted an espaliered quince, and this year we got 5. That was really exciting. But my neighbor down the road has lots, so I went and got a basket from him, and I'm going to, that's what I'm going to do today when I go
so
home.
So what are you going to do with them?
I'm just going to, I'm not going to peel them, I'm just going to core them. And for people who don't know, they're a beautiful yellow fruit. You might think that they're pears as you're driving past them, but they're actually quince. They're really, really hard. And you cut them and you core them. And the seeds, well, in most things, the pectin is in the seeds. But in the quince, I think it's all through. So I'm going to core them.
Do you know, I just want to add too, another thing that there's a lot of confusion is there's an ornamental quince, which is not the same thing. And it even has like a little apple that forms, and that's not a culinary quince.
But they're beautiful.
They're a beautiful flowering ornamental bush. But don't be disappointed if you go, I never get them on that. That's because it's a different plant. It's a totally different different shrub.
Right. But Googling around, I didn't follow the link, but I did see that there are recipes for those little weird quinces.
Oh, there are, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. There's not much fruit on them. I think you'd have to do a lot of work.
It'd be a lot of work.
But anyway, then you just put some You have to put some water because they don't they're not juicy at all. So you have to put some water and you put some sugar and you just slowly, slowly cook them down. And then, of course, I will run them again through the muli. Is that what it's called? The muli, the food mill.
The Foley mill.
Foley mill. Foley
yeah,
food
the
mill.
The Foley
there
food
we go.
Mill. Yeah. You know, I love cooking quince and watching them change color. Yeah. To me, that's just
it's magic.
It really is, you know, because you've got this hard, awful, coarse looking taste. Awful
yeah, it looks
too.
Like a, it looks like you're really slicing a potato, and then all of a sudden, when you're cooking it, it softens and turns into
and turns
this
kind of rosy color,
beautiful
right.
color.
Total jewel tone. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you cook it down until it's really thick and it becomes a paste. Mm-hmm. And then you can either put it in a jar or you can. In most cultures, what they do is they'll layer out in like in a sheet pan and cut it into bricks or blocks.
Yeah, yeah.
That you can put away and then you serve it because it's tart and sweet and wonderful. You serve it with a sharp cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So membrillo, which is the traditional Spanish version, would just go with manchego. That's just that's like peanut butter and jelly. It's membrillo and manchego.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of different cultures. There's a lot of different cultures that have, there's an Italian name for it. There's a French name for the very similar product.
Oh, for the quince paste or the quince jelly or quince jam.
It's pretty, lots of cultures have figured that out. Yeah.
I've made chutney from quince.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's so good. It's really different, but I've made quince chutney.
And you can make fruit crisps or
right. So, I guess I'm going back to your point of when you cook it down and cook it down until it gets like a mush. You don't have to do that. You can cook it in little cubes or bake it, roast it, kind of thing too.
Right.
A British cookbook I have that it's a British cookbook written by an American, and I can't remember the name of it, so I'm sorry that I'm teasing you like this, but I'll bring it next week. But it's one of those you find on a pile on a Friends of the Library, and you go like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And what she does, she had a French neighbor, this is funny, a French neighbor who was living in England, this is written by an American, she made this quince marmalade, and what she did is the cook made the typical sort of mushy pasty thing, but not too solid, still spreadable, and then she went and she grated another couple quince in it and cooked it, and so you had a different texture, and she called it her quince marmalade.
Well, and I saw that recipe and something about that recipe, and it said, which I had never known. I always think of marmalade, of course, as citrus.
Mm-hmm.
But the definition of marmalade is a gel with fruit suspended in it.
Oh, good. That's perfect for this.
Yeah. So any fruit.
Right. That's what,
But
which I always thought was preserves.
Yeah.
But what they said. Yeah.
A rose by any other name.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So I'll be eager to hear how your quince marathon.
Well, you've
goes.
Got the manchego, so
yeah,
I guess I've got my marching orders now.
Yeah, you do. That's for sure.
My stirring orders.
I don't know that I really even have a jam this week. I haven't done much exciting. I did bake a little cake. Actually, I did two. But one that was really interesting was a pumpkin cake with miso and maple. And you... Tom's playing around. That's what you're hearing.
I'm sorry. I was trying to put my mouth breather thing on, so I would be safe in the studio, safer in the studio.
Okay, yeah,
sorry.
It's okay.
My apologies.
Anyway, so it's a tea cake, you know, like in a loaf pan, and it has miso and it has maple in it and pumpkin.
Hmm.
And it's really interesting. It's a cross between like a savory and a sweet. Like you could toast it in the morning and put some marmalade on it. Or you could eat it like a piece of tea cake in the afternoon.
Where'd you get the recipe?
Cream cheese.
New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a really good recipe, and I would make it again, I think. So really, that's all I did. And we're going to post some recipes on the web, and this might be one of them, or a quince recipe or something. We'll decide later. There'll be something there.
There will.
But that's my jam, and that's all I know. So now we're going to talk about Let's talk about some different kinds of things. Like, did you read about or hear about the U.S. Embassy in London and the Oxford Cultural Collective and how they're working together to promote and celebrate the best of American food culture? Now, this is the Oxford Group and the U.S. Embassy, and it's funded jointly by both of them. And it's a new program. And last September, they're talking about American food. And what they, through a series of creative events, they want to introduce guests to renowned cultural ambassadors from all over the world. But right now, they're focusing on America. And
In England?
In England.
Mm. With the U.S. Embassy.
With the U.S. Embassy. And I just think it's wonderful. And the whole idea happened at a Juneteenth dinner in London. And some people were just sitting around talking about how it would be so good to do some cross-cultural exploration of our habits and our loves of food and what we do and how we do it and where it came from. So their first gathering of these international people was September of 2021. And they specialized in African-American food and how food from Africa came to America. And so what they're really saying is, you know, there wasn't much before the Africans got here mm-hmm. and brought in all of these new seeds and vegetables and styles of cooking. And so they're relating all of that to their own needs and their own countries and that kind of thing. So I just thought it was a really neat thing that they're doing, and it's funded by the USDA.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, I think if you want to know any culture, the first place to start is your tummy and your eyes and you know what you see and what you eat and how it's funny, every country has regional specialties that the food is so beloved in, you know, whether it be gumbo in mm-hmm. Louisiana or mm-hmm. Dungeness crab in the Northwest
or lutefisk.
Or lutefisk, exactly. Or hush puppies.
Yeah, hush puppies.
Get some hush puppies, girl.
But to think, actually, that when the people were enslaved and put on the ships, mm-hmm. they were carrying seeds.
They put seeds in the hems of their dresses. They sewed seeds in their dresses.
They had the foresight to do that. Mm-hmm. And the Carolina gold rice that made the fortunes mm-hmm. that was brought by African slaves.
Yeah. Well, they're also focusing on one of the things they did in September was show the movie High on the Hog. Mm-hmm. And they have speakers from culinary historians and doctors and PhD people like that talking about history and food and how you can connect it all in your own world. Yeah. And I love the idea. I just think food's going to save us in the world, you know?
It is. There was a really good show on PBS called, I think, Somewhere South. And Vivian, I'm trying to think the chef. She did the one where she had a restaurant. That show, that was like a several mm-hmm. season thing. But that's not what I'm talking about. She did another show called Somewhere South. That's the name. And but what was so really fascinating about it is she went and tried to do the same thing in the South about cuisines. And so, you know, she would go to the Chinese community in Mississippi and Biloxi, and you'd mm-hmm. go like, who knew? And then you go through the history of why there was such a large Chinese population mm-hmm. in Biloxi, and then their food, the fascinations with different foods from these different groups all throughout the South, and not as typical as you would think. So that was the nice surprise mm-hmm. in the show.
I love that. Love that.
Yeah. Maybe because of the Black Lives Matter thing too, and the pandemic, Marcus Samuelson, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. he's an amazing, born in Africa, mother died. He was adopted into, was it Swedish?
I don't know.
I can't remember, but Norwegian. At any rate, he was raised in a complete opposite culture.
I guess, yeah.
And his sister also. Mm-hmm. And he trained as a chef and had restaurants in New York. And when the pandemic hit, he was like, well, what are we going to do now? And he got together with Jose Andres and they did the kitchen.
They went.
But he's written a a book now that came out of that experience with, and it's all about, it's called Rise, and it's about Black chefs, the new generation of
wonderful.
Black chefs, not Jessica Harris, mm-hmm. not the uh-huh. people from, you know, who've been talking this talk for a long time.
Well, Jessica Harris was yeah. is involved in this whole Oxford thing,
right,
too.
Right, right, yeah.
So I just find that really interesting, and I'm going to keep track of it and see where what they're going to talk about next.
Yeah.
Really. So another thing, I want to talk about horror food because I didn't know there was
Excuse
such
me?
A thing.
Is there two syllables in that?
Horror.
Okay, sorry.
Horror. Scary.
Halloween horror.
Yeah, because, you know, 'tis the season.
Candy
so,
corn? Yes.
No, no. So anyway, there is a restaurant in St. Louis called Terror Tacos. And the welcome is rendered in blood, actually lurid red paint that covers one wall in long drips like the macabre drapery that Satan's gnarled hand might pull back to usher the damned into hell.
This is for a taco?
Yeah, and it's, and get this, it's a vegan restaurant. And the chef, Chef Roach, his name is R-O-A-C-H, put together an all-vegan menu of tacos and burritos featuring his house-made Carnage Asada.
Is this like every, is this just for
it's
season?
It's every day. No, it's every, it's open every day.
Like you can get this in you May as well? In,
yeah, anytime you want. It's okay. There. And it's, can, it has frightful artwork in it, like a screaming woman that looks like Shelley Duvall in The Shining.
Uh-huh.
And they have extreme metal music.
I'm losing my appetite already.
Well, and it's really interesting though. The chef said it's, not for hardcore carnivores, obviously, but he said people keep coming back because not necessarily because the food is plant-based, because they're just excited to eat in a place that's so bizarre. And I really love that. Okay, so there's another one. Oh, I lost my note. Okay, I just lost
it's
my note.
It's always nice to have a theme.
It's always good to
what
have
would
a
your
theme.
What would the theme on your restaurant be? Would you have?
Oh, I'd have diner.
Diner?
I'd have a diner. Yeah.
What about you, Susan?
Oh, I've been there, done that.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you, I've been there, done that.
You are a professional.
Yeah. No, yeah. But on the theme of candy corn, there was a very hilarious thing that went around Facebook this week. And somebody has actually made candy corn that, like, they all look like candy corn, but they taste like this one's turkey and this one's mashed potatoes and this one's gravy. And whoever sampled them had the best sense of humor. I mean, you would laugh and then you would laugh again and then you just keep on laughing
they were,
for every
they
single
They yeah. reviewed it.
They yeah. reviewed it, yeah, and it was really funny.
I bet it was. On to back to the horror restaurants. There are several of them in the United States and they're named, you know, vampire names and
Voodoo People, donuts.
Well, we used to have zombies on the island.
Right. We did have zombies on the island.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a theme, and I just thought it was really interesting. I don't know that I want to go eat there, but maybe just to see it, you know.
Well, we were talking about the art of the table and the table setting and stuff. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine what the table might look like.
Well, yeah, we can use our imagination for that. That's for sure.
And I think too, there's the mood in which you want to eat. Like, is it? Do you want to be excited about something, or do you just want to enjoy a quiet cup of coffee in a cafe somewhere? And I'm raising my hand on that one.
And just kind of be by yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah. With your computer.
Get a croissant.
Yeah. So that section that we just talked about is going to be. We're going to have that be my section.
But what are you going to call it?
We're having a terrible time coming up. We have Tom's Table Talk.
We like alliteration.
We like alliteration. And we have, in a minute, you're going to be introduced to Susan's Spicy Spiel. And now we need Linda's La 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 La. We can't think of L's. And there were some pretty
good
ones.
Well, we thought quite a few. But
yeah, tell me one or two.
But Linda nixed them all.
She rejected them.
You know what they said? They said the lard ass larder.
I think it was. I think it was. Larder. I think it was a little more poetic.
It
than
was
that.
Not. That's.
Or did we say lame ass? Was it?
Yeah,
no,
but,
it wasn't.
Yeah. But you said both.
It did. It got a little less nasty.
Yeah, yeah, it did. But anyway, if you have any suggestions how we might name ourselves in our little suggestions, I think we have our little segments. We have Susan's and Tom's taken care of, but we don't know how to alliterate with L's mm-hmm. and make it food related. Unless and, right, Lutefisk.
And the closest one right now is Linda's Larder.
Yeah, that's yeah. what we're going yeah. for, I think.
But we could, you know, we're flexible here.
I thought there one was one after. There was lasagna, but that.
Yeah, because she's yeah. so layered. yeah. And she didn't like Linda de Leche, so we didn't do that right. one.
No.
Like dulce de leche.
Dulce de leche. So now we're at about the halfway mark through our.
Through the magic of
diatribe
time.
Here.
Yeah, through the magic of time.
I don't know. We did it at the beginning.
Okay.
We don't have to do it now.
All right.
But, excellent. You know, we're at 101.9.
Well, you know,
everybody
I'm just
knows
trying
that.
To
we're not in Chicago.
I know. I know. So our main segment of things that we're going to talk about, along with the chatter that we do at the beginning, is called the main course. And today's main course is food as art. Or food and art, or however you want to say it. But we were all talking last week about how beautiful food can be and how beautiful a table setting can be. And it can really make or break the whole meal. And so we just started exploring different tangents of art and food. And to start this little section, I'd like to read a poem because poetry is art. And that's just part of it. It's not visual, obviously, mm-hmm. but. This one, do you know Elizabeth Alexander, the poet? She's a poet she's the head of the Carnegie Mellon Institute, and she's also a scholar. She lectures at Yale and Harvard, and she's a well-known poet.
And she lectures on poetry or
everything. Yeah. I mean, she's like a sort of all-rounded food historian kind of person.
And what's her name
and
again,
poetry.
Please?
Her name is Elizabeth Alexander. Look her up on the web. She's very interesting. She has a long history of her African-American heritage in the United States is quite bright. She, her grandfather was a doctor and her great aunt was a doctor. And so she comes from a long line of very accomplished people. And she's a writer as well, which I love. And she wrote a poem called Butter. My mother loves butter more than I do, more than anyone. She pulls chunks off the stick and eats it plain, explaining cream spun around into butter. Growing up, we ate turkey cutlets sauteed in lemon and butter, butter and cheese on green noodles, butter melting in small pools in the heart of a Yorkshire pudding. Butter better than gravy, staining white rice yellow. Butter glazing corn in slipping squares. Butter the lava in white volcanoes of hominy grits. Butter softening in a white bowl to be creamed with white sugar. Butter disappearing into whipped sweet potatoes. With pineapple. Butter melted and curdy to pour over pancakes. Butter licked off the plate with warm syrup. When I picture the good old days, I am grinning greasy with my brother, having watched the tiger chase his tail and turn to butter. We are Mumbo and Jumbo's children, despite historical revision, despite our parents' efforts, glowing from the inside out 100 megawatts of butter.
I love that.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, that's pretty special.
Oh,
yeah.
I just loved it. And, that's my contribution. So what you got over there?
Well, interesting enough that we just had a close friend and her two boys as house guests for the last two nights. And the youngest one, Emmett, does not like butter. And I was like,
what?
Huh? Yeah.
Excuse me? Oh,
you don't like butter? Because I forgot what we were making. His mom said, oh, don't do that. Don't put that on Emmett's. He doesn't like butter.
And butter. Really?
And Emmett said butter. Ugh.
Interesting. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure he's going to be highway proportional for the rest of his life, which is awesome for him.
Well, that's probably true. Yeah. That's good for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But butter, you know, it is, I think, like every, and you could, I'm sure, you can speak to this, is every chef's secret ingredient when it needs to, you need some,
oh, yeah.
just a, the soupçon of improvement butter.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know,
ghee.
Yeah,
ghee is great.
Julia Child always said that. Oh, you know, if it fails, just add more butter. She just always more butter.
Yeah.
That'll help.
Totally.
So, yeah. So how about food and art? Do you guys have any thoughts on that? Have you been thinking about it?
Well, I sent you that photo of my friend's artful food that we're going to have, I think, on the website.
Yeah.
When we went to her beautiful brass platter with lots.
It's a wonderful, beautiful design.
Beautiful design. Yeah. Beautiful,
gorgeous
food and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what jumps to my mind first. And then thinking about, we were talking about presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I always think there has to be something green and fresh.
Well, you know, art, that's an interesting subject for me because the art of the table, I'm sure there's a book written with that title, is I can set the table beautifully and do everything really well. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to presentation, I'm kind of a dog. I mean, it just kind of goes on the platter and I don't have any. You, Susan, have an incredible eye with presentation. Is there anything that you could help me with? Help me present my food more.
Well, just whatever you can do to put something fresh on the plate.
Right.
You know, something that, and then balance the colors.
But you do things with like drizzling an olive oil over something and then in a funny little, cute little.
Oh, like on hummus, yeah.
Yeah, you do, and maybe a sprinkle of herbs just on top
zaatar,
of something. Yeah.
Zaatar. We're going to get to zaatar
in
a while.
Yeah.
So,
Well, I like to crochet noodles, so they're particularly. Particularly.
Tom, you didn't do your homework, did you?
No, I didn't. No. I certainly did. Now, we're talking about presentation. I think one of the things that come to mind for me with presentation is growing up and how sort of the family get-togethers that were special occasions. Like we always had birthday, you know, our family all celebrated birthday. Like you knew not to plan anything if there was somebody's birthday.
Right.
And also like the holidays. And so my mom was an entertainer and I mean as far as like she not like Dean Martin, but she was she liked to entertain at home and so she would go to a lot of trouble to really set a beautiful table, and she had you know, everything from the flowers to the tablecloth to the you know, silver and crystal. And in fact, one of the sort of jokes in my family right now is that my mom, when we go there, she has paper plates, and we're going, what is this about? She goes, well, I know you just hate to mess up the, you know, or then she has this crystal that is so beautiful and so fragile that, you know, a butterfly lands on it and it cracks. So, but I love this stuff and I want to drink something out of it. Like, I don't care, milk or Coca-Cola, it doesn't. And she'll go, what are you doing? So I was going to drink out of it. And she goes, I have these over here. And I said, yes, but I do not really want Huckleberry Hound on my glass.
Oh, I think I would.
No.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So I would say the art of presentation at home, at special occasions, you know, how people go to a little extra effort when they have friends and family around.
Right. But I think sometimes it gets too pretentious, you know, like the higher the dollar amount on the food, the more they have twisted it with their little tongs and made a little pyramid of the pasta and the portion is just so, and this food is like sometimes just, well, I could have had that down the street at the diner.
Right.
Yeah. Enjoyed it a little bit more, not quite, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like a balance, but you want it to look pretty when you sit down. You want the table to be, you know, I like, you know, at least a nice clean placemat. And we have cloth napkins all the time. We have napkin rings that are our individual napkin rings, so we can use the same napkin. Goes, you know, so it's not like, you know, you're making mounds of, you know, laundry to do.
Yeah.
And just set the table and have some flowers and kind of just put
simple.
You know, and yeah. It's always fun when you go to dinner with people you don't know and you've just met, and mm-hmm. and everyone has a different reaction to the food, and some have exhausting sort of litany of what they do and don't eat, and they feel the need to tell you, and and then they but one of my favorite moments like that was I was in college. I was working doing a summer job, and there was one of the lawyers in this firm where I was a summer jobbing, mm-hmm. Was from Texas, and we were at this Italian restaurant in Washington, D.C., and it was just hysterical because they'd bring a serving, and he'd look at it, and he goes, well, where's the rest of it, you know? And it was like, he was saying what everybody else was thinking,
well,
like,
sure.
He goes, did you run out of pasta? What's going on here, you know? Because, and it was one of the funniest memories I have of somebody sort of saying what the rest of us were thinking, but we felt we couldn't.
I love that.
Right.
Yeah. Because really, I understand the architectural
you have your
food
best
thing.
Manners.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
You do. Well, you know, another thing to think about that I have to say, I don't know a lot about, but I'm fascinated by art in paintings, art in history, the food that they have and what the different
right.
foods represent, you know?
So do you think that like some of the, when you see these amazing Renaissance paintings that, mm-hmm. you know, was the, what you see true to what people were actually eating?
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much according to what I've read. And I read a lot this week to try to remember some of it.
Yeah.
You know, food, it has roots in classical literature. And so most of the food that you see in those old paintings has something to do with the story from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And
or it's a symbolic meaning.
Right, right. And, you know, they appear widely in mythology, like attributes of the gods and goddesses, like pomegranates, you know, or grapes for Bacchus, the god of wine, a sheaf of corn for Ceres, that kind of thing. And one thing, though, that I learned is that in the, you know, back in the pagan days, the pomegranate in the pagans represented fertility and birth. And it was, you know, Venus holding the pomegranate. It's a sexually infused.
Love apple? Was it considered the love apple?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was also, that's what is it, Persephone was heralded down to Hades because she ate six of the pomegranate
of
seeds.
Of the pomegranate seeds,
yeah.
Yes. And then, let me see, I just want to find, the palm is depicted in mythological paintings as an attribute of Venus because of its many seeds and marriage, okay? So there are several legends of the pomegranate's creation contributing to its symbolic potency. According to one, it grew out of blood streaming from the wounded genitals of the, of the lusted god.
Sorry, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. And then
and we worried about lard ass.
Exactly.
Well, there's always something awful here, you know.
That's one place you don't want wounded.
But, you know, one thing I learned that I did not know, that in Latin, so we're thinking about Eve here with her apple.
Mm-hmm.
And in Latin, the word apple and evil are the same. I don't know that word. I left it at home. But it's the same. So then you have to think about, okay, so how did that evolve into the Bible story?
Well, the Bible story preceded Latin.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know.
Theoretically, I mean, the Bible was written, I mean, we don't know when the first Bible was written. And it's rewritten.
And was it an apple?
It wasn't?
No, I don't know.
It was
I'm thinking there's so many other fruits that, you know, have a little more oomph to them that it would have been.
Yeah, I can think of one.
Well, it was the fruit that imparted the knowledge of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, yeah, but, you know, then
but
I
it
go,
could have been any fruit.
I go back to the, why was it Eve? And, you know, they changed that whole story from the pagan thing. Now the apple represents virtue, or the pomegranate represents goodness and, you know, biblical ideologies,
abundance
and that kind of thing. And in pagan days, it wasn't that. So I just think that's really interesting how religion changes stories.
Yeah.
And
art reflects
and art.
It. Yeah.
Well, that was one of the points of the article I was reading was, gosh, you know, the artists, even back then, were influenced by what's going on in the world around them, just like they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're asking about, did they really eat that food? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think they did.
Yeah. The reason I asked that question, there was, okay, this is where I'm going to sound like I travel a lot. When I was in London once, no, it was like 800 years ago, but there was a show, at the British, I think not the British Museum. It was a British museum.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically about the creative license with the clothing in the old master's paintings. And a lot of, like, for instance, like even like the Sistine Chapel, like the majority of things there, the clothes that are shown are sort of basically just kind of made up by
kind
Michelangelo.
Kind of looking for what they probably really
right,
wore.
What they really did. And other times and time periods were much more, they were completely and totally and utterly accurate. But like in the Renaissance, there was a lot of license with flowy, flowy, shiny fabric and where it went and what it did.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, food is art. I think there is some discussion about that. Ruth Reichel says that food is not art. Cooking is. And Jose Andres says everything in food is art. You know, so they're diametrically opposed to each other.
And he's a generous spirit, so I kind of like his the best.
I like his too, because I think food is art. But, you know, Ruth's a little
prepared
edgy sometimes.
Food. Maybe, I mean.
What do you mean?
Well, okay, so a bowl of oats, just plain oats, dry oats is sitting there. It could be art if the bowl is just so and the light is just
right.
And
right.
The spoon is, you know, just and the you know, the candle is lit or something, you know, that makes it art.
Or pancakes with a raisin smile.
But just the thing by itself, you know, a handful of oats isn't necessarily art.
Yeah.
It's what you've done to it, or how you've portrayed it, or transmogrified it, or whatever that word is, transformed it into, like,
isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, right. So there's something to do with the manipulation of it that makes it art.
Tom, do you have food art in your house? I mean, like on the wall?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I do. I love food art. One of my favorites is a local artist and awesome woman, Donna Romero. And it's a bowl of these yellow transparent apples.
Aren't they wonderful?
Yeah. And I bought that one... many Christmases ago when we had the art tours, the studio tours.
I hope they're going to do that this
year. And it was one of my, it's so beautiful. It's just luscious. You look at that thing and you feel like you could kind of just put your hand on the wall and take one of those apples. Because she does such a beautiful thing with light.
And the way she can do a curtain. I mean, really, seriously, she's an amazing artist.
Yeah.
Really.
So that's one of my favorite food arts.
What about you, Susan?
I do.
You have lots of stuff in your repertoire.
The one that I was thinking of, just trying to picture it exactly in my mind, it's a bowl of peaches, and the peaches are in, I bought it in, you know, for like $10 in Mexico City.
Somebody nice.
Just, you know. The lady on the side of the street with, you know, holding it up, you know, and I'm like, yeah. And so the bowl itself is like blue and white designed pottery, and then the peaches.
And, pretty.
But I also have the one that's, what do you call them? The,
I don't know.
You know, well, the, in Mexico, when you injure yourself or you pray
milagros
you, Well, not the Milagros are like an arm or a leg, yeah. But this is the same one. You've seen it
but
at my
food.
House. Well, this one, no, this they were painted in gratitude on the backs of tin cans.
Oh, right, right.
Right, and that's the word that I'm missing. But it's a picture of the classic kitchen in Puebla. Mm-hmm. With the
retablo,
it's a retablo.
Yes,
thank you. Yeah,
it's a retablo,
and with the little, the mugs are all hanging on the hooks, and the stove is there, and the
nice.
Whole thing. And the woman prayed. She was from Puebla, but her new husband was from Mexico City, and his family was muy rico.
Mm.
She was afraid of what she didn't know what to cook when they were coming, because they were wealthy, and
mm-hmm.
she wanted to impress them. And so she prayed, and she received this recipe, an idea that she was going to cook something. And they liked it so much that they have a restaurant in Mexico City, and they serve it there. And so she was being thankful for this culinary mm-hmm. miracle.
Really?
She had a culinary milagro, and she had it on my birthday.
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
That is.
Before I was born, several years before I was born. But, you know, it
yeah.
was pretty, that was a pretty good find.
That's a wonderful story. There's also so much fascinating history about how we came to be so civilized at our tables and the art of presentation and that kind
of
thing.
That would be something that I'm gonna write. I'm actually writing this down.
Okay.
Because I would love to know sort of the chronological order
mm-hmm.
of
when we got
serving like spoons and knives. Somebody told me knives didn't show up until, you know, like dinner knives till quite a way, and forks
didn't show up for a long time because people ate with their hands for a long time. So I did some sort of cursory research on that,
mm-hmm.
and I would like to talk about that maybe next time or the time after that.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of really interesting history about how we decided to set the table, how we decided to eat the way we eat,
mm-hmm.
and it all came through evolution. And then, of course, within the cultural...
And also to define, I think, sort of your class, the class system. Like, if you look at, like, if you... I'm
True.
A big fan of course I am, silver flatware. And especially from, like, the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so remarkable is if you had, like, a complete set of silverware, you know, mm-hmm. think Downton Abbey, that there's a fork for an oyster, there's a fork for a pickle, there's a little scooped spoon for soft cheese, there's a different shape for a hard cheese, there's a little clip for an asparagus,
I love those little asparagus clip things.
And they're just, everything had a very specific purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But then there are cultures where the table is set, a beautiful cloth on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, washes their hands in rose water.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a platter of food in the middle, and you eat always with
Well, that's
one
always
hand.
Artful. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you scoop the bread. You use the bread to scoop up the food.
Yeah. So are you talking Moroccan?
A lot of
Japanese.
Middle Eastern places,
Japanese,
you know.
Too. Yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
And Ethiopian.
Yeah.
The big bread
mm-hmm.
is the placemat, is mm-hmm. the food, it's the plate, it's the everything.
It's everything,
that
yeah.
would be arranged on
yeah.
it, and you would tear off bits to get the juicy parts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole different, but it's equally artful. Equally
and
artful.
And it's equally painful for us lard-ass Americans.
Oh, I know. I cannot sit cross-legged on a cushion on the floor.
No,
it's a tough one.
No, it doesn't work.
Yeah. But if we had been doing it all our lives,
yes,
true.
We could know.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, maybe.
Are you just ask if the restaurant has a hoist? Do you have a hoist?
How about a winch?
A winch.
Come along.
Party of four for the tow bar.
Belly up.
Yeah.
You know, I owe you all an apology because I skipped all over here.
Yeah.
I just skipped all over our wonderful outline we had, and we haven't heard from Susan's spicy
spiel.
I'm going to spiel.
Say that three times in a row. Susan's spicy spiel.
Maybe we should add special. Susan's special spicy spiel. Specifically.
Specifically.
But you know what?
Specifically this week about za'atar.
Yeah, well, let's talk about za'atar. I am familiar with it, but I don't know if everybody is.
He's my favorite Marvel hero.
Za'atar, is he?
Well, Well, I love the way it's spelled too, because it has a variety of spellings.
Right.
But I think we've pretty much homed in on Z-A apostrophe A-T-A-R.
Right. I think that's it.
And the thing about it that's really interesting, it's all over the Mediterranean and the Middle East. And various cultures discovered it. And nobody can agree. Well, I think scientists are now pretty much agreeing that the name of the herb is Origanum syriacum. But many people call it thyme.
Oh.
And many people call it hyssop. And then there are local blends and family blends, and some of those have been really secret.
So this is sort of like the Italians with their gravies and their sauces. Everybody has a good one.
Yeah.
And it's a different mix and a different
blend.
Right,
but even in families, and the recipes are handed down through generations, and they have their own special blend. So the basic one seems to be the oregano that grew wild, particularly like in Lebanon. And was harvested in Palestine. So it was around the Levant, that part of the Mediterranean. And then it moved over to Morocco. But it's actually was found in the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Really?
So, yeah. So it's people have been eating it and doing that for thousands of years. So the basic, the most productive, where it's commercially produced now, In Israel, it's outlawed. You can't harvest it wild because it's an endangered species now.
Oh.
And the Arabs there think that that's an anti-Arab move because they're the ones who eat the...
And they use it.
They use it. But at any rate, it's...
Do they grow it and cultivate? Is there cultivation, though?
In Jordan,
okay.
And evidently, that's because that's where they can have the cheapest labor because it's very... it's a pretty intense process. Which, you know, the drying and the sifting and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So when I had my restaurant, I was able to get just pure Jordanian za'atar.
Nice.
Which was just a green powder.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it came already with sesame seeds in it.
What did you use it for?
We sprinkled it on pita breads and garnished the hummus and,
a lot
of different things.
Did you use it as a, like with roast chicken? Does za'atar work?
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
You could. Yeah. And it makes it great. You could mix it with olive oil and make it as a dip or use it as a filling in, flatbreads.
Can you describe the flavor? That's a really hard question. I know.
It is. It's herbal.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also mixed it with sumac. And that's very commonly done.
Yeah,
and
pretty
sumac
traditional.
It's very lemony. It's been used in a lot of cultures to make, for a souring agent. I don't know if I was trying to figure out when lemons and citrus, how they've moved through the world.
Mm-hmm.
But sumac was a substitute
for
that.
Very interesting. Yeah.
And then the sesame would give it a little nutty and oily.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they mix it with a little olive oil. So,
do you ever toast it? Do you ever put it in a pan and heat it up a little bit? Like, some spices you heat in a pan dry so it kind of accentuates them or?
Well, like whenever I'm cooking anything, sauteing anything, you put the spices in, you don't want to add it later. You want to add it with the oil with the saute because the oil blends together with the spices. They activate each other.
Oh, okay.
Whereas
if you didn't,
like if you're making chili, put the chili powder in when you're sauteing the onions and the meat. If you don't think it's spicy enough, you can add some later, but you're really getting the depth of flavor when you mix it with the fats,
the heated
fat
oil.
You're
okay.
Doing. Yeah.
It's a great tip, Susan.
I learned something similar to that from Julia Sani, who is
I love her books.
Isn't she wonderful?
Yeah.
She's an Indian cook and cooking
school.
I'm sure
that's where
teacher.
I learned it.
Yeah. And she does culinary tours to India. And I met her a few years ago. And she said, she was teaching a class at a school that I worked at. And she said, you Americans are stirring things too much. She said, you stir too much stuff. And she said, you will never let anything just rest and be itself. And I asked her what she meant by that. And she said, well, take for instance how you use your herbs and spices. She said, you brown your onions and you brown your meat and then you throw a bunch of spices in and then you, And I said, so what should we do? And she said, essentially what you're saying.
Right.
Warm those spices. They mm-hmm. have life.
The other way, you're steaming them and
you're
it's not quite
them
the same.
It's not yeah. the same thing. And she was just
and you're not really frying them, but you just want them to mingle.
You don't want to toast.
Yeah.
Toast
yeah. Really just like
toast
garlic. Them. You don't want yeah. to have that go crazy hot or
right.
you'll
yeah,
make it bitter.
Bitter. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. Thank you, Susan. I don't have za'atar at my house, and now I think I'll get some.
Oh yeah, I'll get you some because I've been experimenting. Well, I just found another one now because it has become really popular.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different varieties of it, and I just bought a jar the other day because I was in a hurry and I saw it and I went, oh. When I got it home, I realized it's almost all sesame seeds with some herbs.
Yeah, mm.
And it should really look like ground up.
Yeah.
Green stuff with sesame mm-hmm. seeds and then the reddish part
yeah.
of the sumac. And yeah. I like to see the sumac that you look at, you see it sumac. I don't like it to be mm-hmm. all so ground together
right.
that it's kind of like a brick.
Right. No.
But anyway, I think that was about all
well,
I had about
you.
It.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I have one more little tidbit that we forgot to talk about.
Oh, no. It's an antioxidant. And they have actually done, because the traditional doctors all the way from the ancient Greeks said it was, and they did an experiment with mice, and they found that it activated the section of the brain that was dopamine. Same
oh, good.
As dopamine.
Make you feel better.
I know. Yeah. See, so it has lots of benefits.
I'm going to sprinkle some on my
well.
Pita.
Yeah. There you go.
Thank you.
Say what, Willis?
You guys are really bad today.
I'm sorry.
So I want to talk about something else that has nothing to do with anything we've talked about.
Okay.
Do you know about, we just have a brief, very brief time, but you know Impossible Burgers and what's Beyond Meats and that mm-hmm. kind of thing, the plant-based meat movement. Well, I happen to really, really like Impossible Burger. I just think it's really good. I don't like the other one, whatever it is. And I was reading an article the other day, and there is now Impossible Pork. And the point I'm making is that apparently having Impossible Pork is raising some really interesting conversations in the Jewish community because it is vegetables. But it's called pork, and so Orthodox Jews probably won't eat it because it's called pork,
mm-hmm.
even though it isn't pork. And then kosher is another problem with it. I talked with one of my Jewish friends yesterday about it because I said, I don't really understand all the kosher things that you have to go through and how that works and why do you have to have kosher if it's a vegetable? I didn't get that. But anyway, she said that for her, it would make no difference because she's a vegetarian because she has nothing to do with being Jewish and it has nothing to do with, you know, animal rights. It has to do with that she doesn't like the taste of meat. So she would never, for her, it wouldn't be a thing.
Oh,
it wouldn't even matter.
The point they made, the point in which they made it to taste like meat is the, not a selling factor for
not
her.
Not for her. No. Uh-huh. And I think that's really interesting. So we were just talking about that, and she said, you know, in the Orthodox community, she said they're very stringent about what they do, and the rabbis have to be there, and it has to be exactly the right way. So if these packages of Impossible Pork are not labeled as kosher, she's pretty sure that they won't. But I just thought it was really interesting because it's, you know, Muslims too.
The halal.
Yeah, with the pork thing too. So... Well, we're down to the last few seconds of our show, and I just would like to thank both of you for being here. You've been just great.
It flies by.
I always have a good time, and I hope you've enjoyed being with us, too, as we depend on you to listen to us and give us some feedback. Help us figure out what we're doing. And we will talk to you in 2 weeks. We'll be back on Tuesday at 3 o'clock. I hope you all have a wonderful couple of weeks ahead, and we'll talk soon.
And lots of good food.
Bye-bye.
Bring tea cake.
Eat well.